Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Holbrook. First on this week's program, Phoenix Sky Harbor flights canceled amid FAA cuts. What to know? Flyers have already faced widespread delays due to the government shutdown, and it may get worse. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on November 7th. Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport will be among 40 high-volume markets whose flights will be reduced by 10% on Friday due to staffing shortages caused by the ongoing government shutdown. The Federal Aviation Administration announced Wednesday that the country's busiest markets will have to make cuts, affecting roughly 3,500 to 4,000 flights daily. According to a list published by CBS News and ABC News, Sky Harbor is one of those airports. That's hardly a surprise, given that Sky Harbor is among the 15 busiest airports in the country. How is Sky Harbor being affected by the cutbacks? Sky Harbor has already faced issues during the government shutdown, which reached 37 days as of Thursday, and is now the longest shutdown in U.S. history. On Tuesday, the FAA issued a ground delay at Sky Harbor due to a shortage of air traffic controllers, delaying more than 340 flights. Federal workers, like air traffic controllers and TSA agents, are expected to work, but are not being paid during the shutdown. On Wednesday, more than 220 flights out of the airport were delayed, and nearly 50 were canceled. On Thursday, by 11:30 a.m., 73 flights were delayed at Sky Harbor, and one was canceled. As of Friday morning, Sky Harbor's website counted 115 affected flights between Thursday morning and Saturday morning, split about evenly between cancellations and delays. Most of those flights were on Southwest and American Airlines. A handful of Alaska, Delta, and United flights were also affected. At least security lines are moving. On Friday morning, the airport's five checkpoints had an average wait time of under 10 minutes. The FAA order will take effect on Friday morning. In an email, Sky Harbor spokesperson Gregory Roybal directed New Times to contact the FAA for further information and encouraged passengers to verify their flight status with their airline before arriving at the airport. "Our sole role is to make sure that we keep this airspace as safe as possible," FAA Administrator Brian Bedford said during a Wednesday press conference. "This is about the pressure and how to really deviate the pressure. To make matters more annoying for travelers, Sky Harbor is currently in the midst of a construction project near Terminal 3, which will cause overnight road closures around the airport starting Sunday and continuing through November 18th. The federal government has been shut down since October 1st, after Congress failed to pass a budget or resolution to fund the government. It could last a while. Republicans are falsely claiming that Democrats are holding out to get health care benefits for undocumented immigrants, while Democrats have said that they are fighting to preserve Obamacare premium subsidies that make health insurance affordable for millions. Unless Republicans ditch the filibuster, as Trump has demanded they do, the GOP needs to convert some Democratic senators to reopen the government. Otherwise, the sides will have to sit down and negotiate their way out. What do I do if my flight is canceled at Sky Harbor? Many airlines are offering refunds or rebookings depending on the situation. Call the airline you're flying to see what they're offering to customers amid the reduction. Here's what to expect for the major airlines. American Airlines. In a statement Thursday morning, American Airlines said it expects flights on Thursday to operate as planned and expects the vast majority of its customers to be unaffected. Long-haul international flights, which are typically 6 hours or longer, will continue as scheduled. However, the airlines did encourage flyers to check their flight status. Customers whose flights are canceled or who choose not to fly will be able to change their flight or get a refund without penalty. Delta. Delta expects most of its flights to operate as scheduled, including its long-haul international flights, it stated in a press release Thursday morning. Travelers will be able to cancel or refund their flights, including Delta main basic fares, without penalty during the shutdown. Delta said flyers should check their flight status to stay informed about potential changes. Southwest. In a short statement on Wednesday, Southwest said it doesn't expect international flights to be affected and said it will work proactively to communicate with flyers well in advance and offers flexibility in travel plans. Information surrounding potential refunds wasn't included in their announcement, though Southwest fares are generally refundable. The majority of the delays on Thursday morning at Sky Harbor were for Southwest flights. JetBlue. The airline said in a press conference that it'd reach out to affected customers directly if their flight is impacted by the reduction. In most cases, flyers will be automatically rebooked to the next JetBlue flight. Customers can also request a full refund. United. In a statement, United Airlines said long-haul international flights and hub-to-hub flights won't be impacted. However, Sky Harbor is not one of United's hubs, so passengers traveling to those hubs, including Chicago O'Hare Airport, Denver International Airport, and Dulles International Airport, could still experience delays. Reductions will be scheduled for regional flying and domestic mainline flights, including flights from Sky Harbor to other U.S. cities. Any customer traveling during this period is eligible for a refund if they don't want to fly, even if their flight isn't impacted. This includes both non-refundable tickets and basic economy tickets. United still plans to have 4,000 flights a day across the country. Frontier. During the reductions, Frontier stated that it expected most flights to operate as scheduled, but would make adjustments to the flight schedule as necessary and communicate with customers proactively. Customers can rebook or request a refund for domestic flights that are canceled or delayed for more than 3 hours. Customers can do the same for international flights that are canceled or delayed for more than 6 hours. They've also issued a flexible travel policy for customers who'd like to cancel or change their plans during the shutdown. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on November 7th. More than 1,000 teachers have quit in Arizona since July. Why? When applying for a job, it's considered wise to ask why the position became open in the first place. Was the previous occupant promoted? Did that person seek greener pastures? Or did they die at their desk of exhaustion and stress? If you want to be a teacher in Arizona, the good news is that there are plenty of openings. The bad news is that many are vacant because hundreds of fed-up teachers decided to take their rulers and leave. On Thursday, the Arizona Department of Education released a study on teacher vacancies in the state, finding that a whopping 1,055 public school and charter school teachers have quit since July 1st. Of those, nearly 300 have quit since the current school year began. At public schools, nearly 2% of teachers have hung up the grading rubrics since the summer. The trend is worse at charter schools, which have proliferated in Arizona. Nearly 6% of charter school teachers have quit in that same span. In a press release announcing the study, Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn called those numbers intolerable, adding that we absolutely must raise teacher salaries. Horn did not return a request for comment, but few would argue with that assessment. In Arizona, the average teacher salary is less than $63,000, which is about $10,000 less than the national average, according to the National Education Association. That 1,000 teachers would bail on the profession may be surprising, said Arizona Education Association President Marciola Garcia, but the number is not shocking to anyone who works in public schools. It's a clear indicator that the lack of investments in our public school results in quality educators leaving the profession, Garcia said. Horn has another theory as to why teachers are quitting, one that many teachers don't quite buy. Teachers are leaving, he said, because administrators are not supporting teachers in disciplining students. Actions have to have consequences, he said in a video posted to the department's YouTube page. Like with Horn's war against pride flags and diversity programs, education advocates say he's missing the real story. There are bigger fish to fry than disciplinary issues, said Tyler Couch, a spokesperson for advocacy group Save Our Schools. Garcia added that if schools only suspend students when they get in trouble and don't do anything else, those students come back and no real change is accomplished. Teachers don't feel supported, they say, but in a much more basic sense. Arizona schools are underfunded, ranking 48th in the nation in per-student spending, according to the National Education Association. Meanwhile, according to the Common Sense Institute, the state spent an estimated $882 million in taxpayer money for empowerment scholarship accounts, much of which went to help students who were already in private schools to begin with. Classrooms are overcrowded, and school districts can't afford support staff like reading interventionists, teachers' aides, nurses, librarians, and counselors. When seasoned teachers leave, inexperienced ones take their place, leaving to the exploitation of the veterans who are still there to fill the experience gap and take on the extra burden, Garcia said. Who's going to pick up the slack for that? Teachers, Garcia said. I can't have a kid just bleeding in my classroom and not address it. I cannot have a student who comes in hungry and not address it. For all that, teachers have to be wary of not stepping on the many culture war landmines laid down by increasingly right-wing school board members and conservative parent groups. Couch pointed to the group of math teachers in Vail who received more than 3,000 death threats for wearing Halloween costumes that hyper-online right-wingers, including several Arizona politicians, wrongly claimed were meant to mock the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Notably, despite firing off press releases about Black Lives Matter stickers and other right-wing talking points, Horn hasn't put out any statement of support for those embattled teachers. No wonder so many leave, Couch said. If I'm a teacher, and I'm seeing teachers getting death threats because they wore silly Halloween costumes, he said, that's going to make me really second guess what I'm doing on my job. Arizona Representative Ansari trolls House Speaker for covering up Epstein files. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on November 6th. In Washington, D.C.'s rotting corridors of power, Phoenix's freshman congresswoman just added a new title to her impressive resume, Congressional Meme Lord. Representative Yasemin Ansari, a Democrat who represents Central Phoenix, was spotted Thursday afternoon at the U.S. Capitol with a table set up outside of the office of Speaker Mike Johnson, complete with a handwritten sign. Mike Johnson is starving families and gutting health care to cover up the Epstein files, the sign said. Change my mind. For those unfamiliar with internet culture, the setup is an allusion to a widely recognized meme that has been repurposed countless times since it surfaced in 2018. Around that time, conservative podcaster Steven Crowder visited a college campus and sat at a table with a similar sign, in a stunt to bait verbally combative students into an argument about whether male privilege is a myth. The now iconic photo of Crowder smugly holding a coffee cup became a canvas for anyone with Photoshop abilities to edit and make their own hilarious claims about anything at all. Ansari took the meme to the next level by reenacting it. The resulting photo, taken by NBC News reporter Sahil Kapoor, is a fairly effective way to boil down what's happening in Republican-controlled Washington, which is mired in a record-breaking government shutdown. Republicans are holding our government hostage to force health care cuts and hide the Epstein files, Ansari told Phoenix New Times in a written statement. They control all branches of government and refuse to even talk to Democrats on a path forward. Ansari noted that if Republicans refuse to extend Obamacare subsidies that help people afford health insurance, which Democrats have been fighting for, roughly 370,000 Arizonans will lose access to affordable health care. Ansari also called out the Trump administration's refusal to fund the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, which is leaving hundreds of thousands of Arizonans unable to afford food. Johnson has also kept the House of Representatives in recess for all of October and into November. Even Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican who was once MAGA's biggest cheerleader, said Congress not being in session was an embarrassment. Mike Johnson needs to call back the House, come to the table, and actually talk with Democrats on a solution, Ansari wrote. I stood ready to talk today. Johnson's choice to keep the House out of session is also keeping the details from the federal investigation into sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein from being released. That largely appears to be why Johnson has refused to swear in Tucson Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva, who won a special election 42 days ago. Grijalva would become the deciding vote on a discharge petition that would lead to the release of the Epstein files. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on November 6th. The election skeptic county recorder just lost his first court battle. America loves a loser. At least Justin Heap better hope so. Since taking office as Maricopa County recorder in January, the MAGA-aligned Heap has waged a bitter power struggle with the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, which is controlled by members of his own party. Heap, whose office handles mail ballots and voter registration, claims the board is handicapping his ability to do his job. The board, particularly board chair Thomas Galvin, has essentially, but not literally, said Heap is full of shit. After committing a series of blunders in his first few months in office, Heap raised the stakes by suing the board on June 12th, claiming the board was not negotiating in good faith over a shared services agreement that delineates election duties between the recorder and the county elections department. More recently, Heap's office asked a judge to issue a preliminary injunction to halt a planned third-party audit of county IT systems, an audit that the board has noted Heap originally requested. Thursday, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Scott Blaney sent Heap's argument home packing. In a short ruling that allowed a hearing earlier in the week, Blaney denied the preliminary injunction, giving Heap his first official loss in court. This is the right outcome, attorney Corey Langhofer, who is representing the board, wrote in an email to New Times. Honestly, it wasn't a close call. It's not clear if Heap will appeal the ruling. The recorder's office did not respond to her request to comment. Heap has felt targeted by his fellow Republicans on the board since before he took office. The previous recording, centrist Republican Stephen Richer had signed away some of the recorder's office's responsibilities and IT infrastructure in a lame duck SSA in the months before he left office. Heap canceled that deal once he took over and has been at loggerheads with the Board of Supervisors ever since. In June, Heap sued the board, rankling Republican County Attorney Rachel Mitchell. Heap did not seek permission from Mitchell to hire his attorney in the case, James Rogers of America First Legal, setting off a fight about whether Rogers can actually represent him. Rogers has continued to represent Heap in this case. Neither Mitchell nor Rogers responded to New Times' request to comment. Injunction fight. Rogers filed the motion for a preliminary injunction last month to attempt to stop an IT audit by the Intersect Group, which the board had hired through a request for proposal process. The motion argued that the audit was nothing more than a vehicle to seize control of the systems and databases at issue in this case, and added that his team was left out of the meetings and the audit process. He asked the court to prevent the Intersect Group from beginning the audit. The board fired back that Heap has asked for a similar audit of the county's election systems in a January budget proposal, decrying Heap's schizophrenic positioning that ensnares the county in a catch-22. No one has ever purported to obstruct the recorder's participation in the assessment, the county wrote in response to the injunction request. Heap also alleges that the auditors would be able to read, copy, or alter confidential voter information. The board rejected that as false because the Intersect Group had been carefully vetted, had signed an NDA, and were subject to the same background checks that have long applied to temporary employees whom Maricopa County hires directly to assist on voter registration matters. In his ruling, Blaney expressed concern over the protection of voters' information during the audit, but said he was credibly informed that the board had taken proper privacy precautions. As such, Blaney found that Heap's arguments did not show the possibility of irreparable injury, which is required to issue such an injunction. Today's ruling is a win for Maricopa County voters and anyone who values election integrity, Galvin wrote in a statement after the ruling. It confirms that the assessment is safe and being conducted in a manner, or rather being conducted in a manner, that will allow the important work of elections to continue while protecting the security of voter information. On X, Richer couldn't help but take a shot at his successor. Lawsuits I lost in office of 40-plus equals zero. That's not the recorder's office anymore. Yes, yes, I lost one lawsuit regarding the MVD issue with Secretary Fontes, but we were filing just in the hopes that we'd get clear instructions, and I was very happy to have lost. The Intersect Group estimates its audit of the county's voter registration automation system will take 14 weeks to complete. The system includes the voter registration system, ballot information, signature verification, and curing for mail-in ballots, to name a few. The audit is not expected to be done until after the 2026 primaries, which Heap's lawsuit claimed effectively denies his statutory authority for the duration of his term, and is puzzling, unnecessary, and wasteful of taxpayer dollars. The total project is expected to cost the county roughly $300,000. Here's a story written by Jared McDonald Evoy of the Arizona Mirror and posted on the Phoenix New Times website on November 5th. Bullet from Mesa police shootout hits ICE deportation plane. an airplane used for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement deportation efforts, was hit by a stray bullet last week during a shootout between Mesa police officers and a suspect at Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. ICE officials said the stray bullet didn't impact the aircraft's ability to fly, and it wasn't clear who fired the bullet that struck the plane. In the early morning hours of October 29th, the Mesa Police Department responded to a trespassing call at a private property near the airport, where officers encountered 34-year-old Cameron Oberlin. Oberlin had already been asked to leave by a private security guard for trespassing. When police arrived, he fled, and police used a grappler device to stop his car, according to media reports. After a standoff, Oberlin and officers fired at each other, and one officer was struck in his right side. That officer has since been released from the hospital, according to a Mesa Police Department spokesperson. Oberlin died from what Mesa police said was a self-inflicted gunshot wound to his head. A contracted charter aircraft, N-801XT, was struck by a stray bullet while parked on the tarmac at Mesa Gateway Airport in Mesa, ICE said in a statement to the Arizona Mirror. The bullet bounced off the plane and no damage was reported. The incident was reported to the Mesa Police Department. The aircraft was not scheduled for a flight on the day of the incident, and its airworthiness was not affected. Operations were not impacted. Mesa police did not provide further information when asked about ICE's statement and if they had determined who the bullet belonged to. Arizona, and specifically Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, plays a crucial role in ICE's aerial deportation efforts, which have surged during President Donald Trump's second term. The airport hosts the agency's headquarters for its deportation flights, known informally as ICE Air, which uses subcontractors and subleases to disguise deportation aircraft. The airport is also home to a lesser-known detention facility. While ICE said that the aircraft was not impacted by the bullet, historical flight data shows the aircraft was used the next day, but its flight was aborted minutes after takeoff when the plane turned around and landed without incident. It has not left the airport since. ICE did not respond to follow-up questions about the aborted flight. The aircraft is owned by Avelo Airlines, which has been making deportation flights out of Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport amid increasing public scrutiny. The company has begun painting the aircraft it uses all white, removing their livery as protests of Trump's deportation agenda have intensified. Prior to being struck by the stray bullet, the aircraft had been regularly flying to other ICE detention facilities, as well as countries, including Honduras and Guatemala. Remember that if you miss any of the stories in this program, or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, click on On-Demand Podcasts. Scroll down to the program you're interested in and click on Listen. The program continues now with this story by Morgan Fisher, posted on November 5th. A law says cops must sell the gun that killed her husband. Will it change? In 2012, the Arizona legislature passed a law requiring police departments to sell guns seized in crimes rather than destroy them. Julie Erfel never expected the law to affect her, but this year it did, reopening an awful wound from her past. Nick Erfel, Julie's husband and a Phoenix cop, was killed in 2007 while on duty, shot twice in the back of the head while arresting a suspect. There was no trial for his murderer, who was killed during a police standoff shortly after. Without closure, Erfel, who was left to raise the couple's two young boys, found herself fixating on the gun that killed him. Over the years, she wondered about the gun's past, who sold it to her husband's killer, and where it came from before that. She never thought much about the gun's future, assuming it had been destroyed. That was the end of the story, she told Phoenix New Times. It wasn't. After years of trying to wring information on the weapon from the Phoenix Police Department, a saga that became more difficult when the lead detective on her husband's case, Michael Polk, was arrested on child porn charges and subsequently fired, Erfel recently learned the department still had the gun and planned to sell it at auction, as Arizona law requires. I still can't believe this is happening. This feels very surreal, Erfel recalled thinking. I want it destroyed. This needs to be destroyed. Last month, she filed a lawsuit to stop the sale of the gun, citing Arizona's Victims' Bill of Rights, which it enshrined in the state constitution. The suit references a CBS News investigation that found that between 2006 and 2022, more than 52,000 guns sold by police agencies ended up at crime scenes. That number doesn't include guns collected at crime scenes and then resold. However, the victim's Bill of Rights pertains more to court proceedings, which never occurred in her husband's murder because the suspect was killed. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego has stated that the city has no plans to sell the gun, but Erfel knows that if she wants to guarantee that outcome, the law that bars its destruction will have to change. Guns are no longer just guns after they've been used to harm your loved one, to take their life, Erfel said. It becomes a symbol of that violence. It's so much more than a weapon at this point. The lawsuit aside, repealing the 2012 law is now her biggest goal, she said. It just doesn't make sense. Since going public with her lawsuit, she's received some high-profile and bipartisan support. At a press conference last month, Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, a Republican, said she'd stand by side with Erfel to get the law changed. Erfel said she'd take Mitchell up on that offer to put pressure on the legislature to change that law. Democratic Representative Yasemin Ansari, who attempted to block the sale of weapons used in crimes when she served on the Phoenix City Council, also said she'd like to join Erfel's fight. We should be taking any and all measures to curb gun violence, Ansari told New Times. Erfel said she's received similar support from the Arizona Attorney General's office, which is run by Democrat Chris Mays. None of those officials has a vote, though. Changing the law will require convincing state legislators. Repeal chances. New Times reached out to several state lawmakers, including two of the bill's original sponsors, State Senators J.D. Mensard and David Gowan, but most declined to comment. One exception was Republican State Senator John Kavanaugh, who now serves as the majority leader in the Arizona Senate. Kavanaugh was one of the bill's original sponsors. Kavanaugh said the 2012 bill aimed to prevent municipalities from destroying workable guns they could have sold to relieve the expense burden on taxpayers, he said in an interview this week. He specifically pointed to the Tucson Police Department as one that was destroying weapons because they're anti-gun, anti-Second Amendment. The 2012 bill, which was signed by Republican Governor Jan Brewer and became law a year later, requires agencies to sell the firearms to any business that is authorized to receive and dispose of the firearm. In that context, dispose of does not necessarily mean destroy. The law was first in a series of bills that aimed to eliminate the destruction of guns, which became more popular through police-run gun buyback programs. Instead of destroying the guns police collected, agencies were instead required to sell them, which basically negated the point of any buyback programs in the first place. We said, hey, this is money. You're burning money, Kavanaugh said. It hurts the taxpayers. So sell it like everybody else. At the time, the legislation was passed with little noise or controversy, as it strengthened an existing state law mandating the sale of confiscated weapons. As it stands, there are no exceptions for guns that are used in homicides. Kavanaugh said Erfel's story is a unique situation that never came up when the law was passed, though he acknowledges that the law should take it into account. Had this been known when the law was written, I'm sure there would have been an exception for guns that are used in homicides, he said. I have no doubt of that. Though Erfel is pushing to strike the law from the books, Kavanaugh said he does not support a full repeal of the law, which he claimed is not doable. But amending the law to account for situations like Erfel's is more realistic. Kavanaugh told New Times that he'd have to talk to his colleagues about that change, but he suspects it'd find support because selling the weapons is highly insensitive to families of homicide victims. Guns that were used to kill people should be allowed to be destroyed, Kavanaugh said. The earliest that effort can meaningfully begin is January, when the next legislative session is set to begin. Any change to the law must survive multiple committees in both the Arizona Senate and the Arizona House of Representatives before being passed by both bodies and sent to Governor Katie Hobbs for signature. Handicapping its chances is difficult. Other popular bills, like a 2024 measure to criminalize lying about military service for material gain, faced a rough road to passage. Republicans control both legislative chambers, and at least one other GOP member is open to changing the law. First-term State Representative James Taylor, who serves on the House's Public Safety Committee, told New Times in an email that while he's not in favor of a full repeal, he would be amenable to debate an amendment that allows victims to request destruction of a firearm. For Erfel, that would be a start. If the law is changed, if it's repealed, then there's no need for this lawsuit, she said. There is no policy about informing victims about when those guns go to auction. I want to be notified. Ex-Phoenix bud tender sues Story Cannabis for stealing worker tips. This next story was written by TJ LeHeru and posted on November 5th. For about 9 months in 2024, Samantha Cooley worked as a bud tender at the Story Cannabis Dispensary on McDowell Road near Interstate 17. In that time, she claims, the dispensary wrongfully withheld tips that customers left when making purchases. Cooley is making those claims in a federal lawsuit filed on October 29th, along with two other former bud tenders who worked at Story Cannabis dispensaries in Ohio and Maryland. The trio alleges that Story Cannabis violated the Fair Labor Standards Act by giving a portion of their tips to dispensary supervisors. The three plaintiffs filed the lawsuit on behalf of themselves and all others similarly situated, meaning that they hope the case becomes a class action suit. Story Cannabis has 11 Arizona locations, according to its website. One of its stores in the Valley, located in North Chandler, is unionized, according to United Food and Commercial Workers Local 99 spokesperson Drake Ridge. The lawsuit claims that at least 200 of the company's employees are potential plaintiffs. Story Cannabis did not respond to Phoenix New Times' request for comment on the lawsuit and its tip-pooling practices. A manager at the McDowell store, who identified himself as Gilbert, but refused to provide his last name, declined to answer questions about whether supervisors take home tips. Tips are the property of the employees, but the company unlawfully retains those tips by including the bud tenders, supervisors, and managers in the tip pool, and by wrongfully utilizing tips to make up cash register shortages, Sarah Block, an attorney for the plaintiffs, told New Times in a statement. Unfortunately, illegal tip pooling and tip theft is commonplace in the cannabis industry. The lawsuit claims company policy requires the tips to be pooled among a group of employees that includes bud tenders, their direct supervisors, inventory managers, and sometimes high-level employees like store managers and general managers. Tips are divided in proportion to the total number of hours each employee worked that day, the lawsuit says. But because the supervisor-level employees work more hours, they receive a larger portion of the tips than do bud tenders, even though the bud tenders perform the customer-facing work. The lawsuit also claims that the dispensaries regularly use tips from the tip pool to cover shortages in the cash registers, cutting down on the tips bud tenders ultimately receive. The lawsuit says bud tenders customarily and regularly earn more than $30 per month in tips. The three former workers argue that supervisors should not have been paid from the tip pool and say that they are entitled to back pay compensation and benefits for losing out on that tip money, as well as an additional amount equal to the unpaid tips as liquidated damages. The former workers and their lawyers are calling for other bud tenders, current and former, to join them in a class action lawsuit. Ridge, whose union has helped organize bud tenders in several Valley dispensaries, including the one unionized Story Cannabis location, told New Times that it was standard practice for bud tenders to take home any tips they received before the legalization of recreational marijuana in 2020. After that, large conglomerates took over the industry and tip pooling became more common. Some companies only tip out bud tenders, while others include traditionally non-tipped employees like back-of-house inventory employees, Ridge said. Often there is little transparency on how much money is in the tip pool and what percent of that pool employees are receiving when tipped out. He added that he heard of one other instance of management taking a cut of tips, but was not sure how prevalent that practice is across the industry. Here's a story written by TJ LeHeroux and posted on November 3rd. Phoenix cops broke teen's wrists, told him his dad should beat him. In January 2024, in the midst of a U.S. Department of Justice investigation that wound up finding a disturbing pattern of abuse against children, three Phoenix cops arrived at a family's home late one night. By the time they left, roughly 45 minutes later, they had tackled a 16-year-old boy, broken his wrist, and busted open his chin. In between, the cops told the boy's father that he should beat his son and threatened to handcuff the boy because he was being, quote, a brat. They also ignored claims from the boy and his 18-year-old sister that the father had been allegedly abusing them. The incident, which is captured in body-worn camera footage obtained by Phoenix New Times, is now the subject of a lawsuit. The boy, Sergio Nino III, is suing the city of Phoenix and the three officers involved for battery and excessive force. The lawsuit was filed in Maricopa County Superior Court on October 27th. City of Phoenix spokesperson Dan Wilson and Phoenix Police Department spokesperson Sergeant Rob Scherer both declined to comment. Scherer also did not respond to a question about whether the three officers are with the department or faced any discipline related to the incident. While Nino III declined an interview with Phoenix New Times, his lawyer provided a statement on the case. This lawsuit exposes how Phoenix police officers not only ignored their legal duty to protect a teenager, but actively encouraged his abuse and then brutalized him for exercising his right to record them, attorney Larry Wolkins said. Sergio Nino was a 16-year-old boy in his own home. Instead of safeguarding him, the officers told his father to beat him, fractured his wrist, and left him scarred for life. What happened to Sergio is indefensible and unconstitutional, in this case seeks to hold the city of Phoenix accountable for allowing that culture of impunity to persist. Nino III is seeking general and compensatory damages, punitive damages, and reimbursement for attorneys' fees and court costs. The lawsuit did not name a dollar amount, and Wolkin did not respond to a New Times inquiry about how much in damages Nino's team wanted to secure. The lawsuit claims that the officers caused Sergio significant harm, including but not limited to a 3-centimeter-long facial laceration, permanent facial scarring, a broken wrist which required surgery, and severe mental pain and suffering. Your dad should beat you. Around 12:30 a.m. on January 23, 2024, officers Blake Willer, Christopher Grease, and Matthew Smith responded to a call at a North Phoenix home. The homeowner, a middle-aged man named Sergio Nino Jr., had called after having issues with his son, Nino III. Speaking to the officers in his living room, Nino Jr. explained that he was at the end of his rope with his son, whom he described as having mental issues. He said Nino III didn't listen to him, and that Nino III wouldn't turn over his phone, which Nino Jr. claimed he paid for. Nino Jr. also referenced other calls to police about his son that New Times could not confirm. "I want him to end up someplace he can get help, a juvenile center, because this isn't going away," Nino Jr. said. "He has no fear because the cops have been over and nothing gets done." Nino Jr. also told the officers that he was hesitant to physically discipline his son, at which point Willer enthusiastically endorsed subjecting the teen to physical violence. "You drag him. You hit him. He's a child. He only has rights from the government," Willer told the father. "He has no rights from you. If you wish to beat him, beat him. If you wish to belt him, belt him." The officers also advised Nino Jr. to throw his son out on the streets and to explore legal emancipation for Nino III so that he was no longer his father's responsibility. Nino Jr. then took the officers to his son's room. Nino III exited the room after the fathers knocked, though Grease put a hand on his chest to restrain him from going to the room of his 18-year-old sister, who then came out of her room. Nino III told officers that his father had tackled him and called him a little bitch. Nino III's sister can be heard seeming to confirm his version of things. "I mean, I'm going to have to agree. I don't think that's okay," she said. Shortly after this, Nino Jr. demanded his daughter turn over her phone and her keys, telling her she was kicked out of the house. The officers, who the lawsuit notes, are mandatory reporters and obligated to investigate claims of child abuse, cared little. "He can assault you. That is discipline when you're a juvenile," Willer told Nino III at one point. While corporal punishment is indeed legal in Arizona, the law says it must be reasonable and appropriate and cannot result in injury. "Your dad should beat you," Willer told him. "Other than sending you to the hospital, your dad should beat you." At another point, Grease threatened to handcuff the 16-year-old. "We can put you in handcuffs right now," Grease said. "Just detain you, because you're being a little brat." Notably, the DOJ found Phoenix cops regularly handcuffed minors without justification. In a new youth interaction policy, currently up for public comment, the Phoenix Police Department now says cops should not handcuff kids to intimidate or scare them, or cuff them when they are not under arrest or detained and or do not pose a safety risk. Busted chin, broken wrist. At one point during Nino III's conversation with the officers, he took out his phone and began recording Willer, saying that he wanted to get it on the record that Willer said it was okay for his dad to hit him. Willer then snatched the phone away from Nino III, who turned to grab for it. Seconds later, he was on the ground, bleeding profusely from his chin. The officers claimed in their incident report that as Nino III grabbed for the phone, he pushed officers and moved as if to punch them. The son used his left arm and pushed it against my chest and balled up his right fist and extended it toward me, Wooler wrote in the report. I believe he was attempting to strike me in the face for taking the cell phone. However, body cam footage does not clearly show Nino III do anything but grab for his phone after Wooler snatched it from his hands. Whatever Nino III did, the officers responded by physically restraining him, throwing him against the wall, and then sweeping his leg so that he landed face down on the floor with a thud. Body cam footage shows blood immediately covering the floor from a gash in his chin. You're going to jail for aggravated assault, Wooler shouted over the teen. Nino III's attorney said the charges against him were later dismissed without prejudice. The officers then picked up Nino III and walked him outside the house. As he is being escorted out, body cam footage shows Nino Jr. pointing at his bleeding and handcuffed son and saying, "See what I told you?" and sat him down on the curb while they waited for paramedics from the Phoenix Fire Department to arrive. During that time, Nino III complained more than 25 times, per the lawsuit, that his cuffs were too tight and that he was losing circulation in one of his hands. The officers dismissively told him the cuffs were fine, although body cam footage does show them checking the cuffs at several points. Once Nino III was at a hospital, nurses alerted the officers that one of his wrists was broken. After reviewing body cam footage, it was determined that Nino III's right wrist was in front of his body when he made contact with the ground, Grease wrote in his report. It appeared that his wrist was limp when he was handcuffed on the ground, which we did not notice until we reviewed the body cam footage. While waiting for paramedics for roughly 20 minutes, a period during which no officer can be heard reading Nino III his Miranda rights, though they continued to speak to him, Nino III told officers that they had misread his family's situation. He told them that his mother struggled with alcohol and would choke him before her death when he was 11. He also claimed he witnessed Nino Jr. physically abuse his mother. Nino Jr. did not respond to a request for comment on that allegation. Court records from Rock Island County, Illinois, where Nino Jr. used to live, show that he pleaded guilty to assault in 1995, paying $340 in fines after apparently pleading down from a charge of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. 3 years later, Nino Jr. was charged with battery, though court records show the charge was dismissed. It is not clear who the alleged victim was in either case. Nothing in the police incident report from Nino III's arrest suggests that the officers took Nino III's abuse allegations seriously. In fact, the report says that after the teen told medical staff about his alleged abuse, the staff reached out to officers to report it. We explained the circumstances around what had occurred and his recent behavior, Grease wrote. We also notified medical staff that he had made no statement to us at any time that his father is actually abusing him. That last part, as body cam footage showed, was patently false. Despite being mandatory reporters of child abuse, the lawsuit states, the officers outright dismissed Sergio, telling him that he had not been abused and that Mr. Nino can hit Sergio, tackle him, and verbally abuse him. Cops have a disciplinary record. The three officers involved in Nino III's arrest have been involved in a total of 37 use of force incidents since 2019, according to a police database. None of them involved a gun. Nino III's lawsuit lays out a particularly lengthy list of civilian complaints against Wooler, the officer who snatched the teen's phone and who body cam footage shows was largely responsible for escalating the situation. According to the lawsuit, Wooler's personnel file shows he has received several other similar complaints throughout his career regarding rude or unprofessional behavior towards citizens and supervisors. In 2023, per the lawsuit, Wheeler served an order of protection to a husband in a family home. The man's wife complained that she felt in danger because Officer Wheeler told her to shut up and told her if she spoke out one more time, she would go to jail and he would give her children to DCS, the lawsuit states, quoting the woman's complaint. As a result, Phoenix Police Department officers discussed with Wheeler the importance of maintaining composure and not allowing emotions to get too elevated. The lawsuit says Wheeler was mandated to discuss interpersonal communications with the department's leadership and curriculum administrator. That same year, Wheeler responded to a call about a family dispute when he pushed to the ground and handcuffed a 14-year-old girl. The lawsuit says the father protested his daughter being handcuffed, only to be pushed by Wheeler. In a third incident, for which the lawsuit gives no date, Wheeler responded to a mother who called police out of concern for her minor daughter's relationship with an adult. Wheeler refused to verify the suspect's age and appeared unwilling to conduct an appropriate investigation, the lawsuit states, quoting Wheeler's personnel file. Another officer on the scene verified the age of the suspect, who was eventually arrested. The department's Professional Standards Bureau found that Wheeler was argumentative, dismissive, and reluctant to verify the suspect's age, and that the other officer's intervention likely prevented Officer Wheeler from neglecting his duties. The lawsuit also notes that Smith was issued a written reprimand for a 2023 incident in which he pushed a 14-year-old girl's neck and chest after she spat on him. The girl was in a clinic after having made self-harm statements. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.